This part of our meeting is about understanding the teaching of the Bible and seeking to apply that teaching to our lives. Now, I know that for some of you, reading the Bible is quite a new experience. And what makes it more difficult is that we're looking at a part of the Bible which is much nearer the end than the beginning, much more than three quarters of the way through the Bible. And most books, when you read them, you recognise it's wise to start at the beginning. If you're going to understand what the book is saying, you start at the beginning and you read through that way. So if reading the Bible is new to you, what we're doing this morning is challenging. And starting reading a new book more than three quarters of the way through makes it even more challenging. If you're going to understand what you read, then there are things you need to know first. I think you could compare it with something that some of you are familiar with, which is moving to another country. The international students are all familiar with that, and so are some of you who now live in Newtown. And I wonder what you learned about the UK before you came here. I think there were two sorts of things it would have been helpful for you to know before you came to the UK. The first sort of thing it's helpful to know are basic facts, things that people who live in the UK would have known. People who'd lived there all their lives, lived here all their lives, would just learn as they grew up. But it would be helpful for you to know them. Perhaps, for instance, someone told you before you came that it rains a lot in the UK. And perhaps you were told before you came, well, look, often it isn't very warm in the UK. And knowing those things in advance would have been helpful, wouldn't it? Because if they'd told you that before you came here, you would have packed a waterproof coat, you might have bought an umbrella, and you'd have brought lots of warm clothes when you came to Britain. Then the second sort of thing that it would have been helpful for you to know were things about the culture of the particular place you were travelling to. Because not everywhere in the UK is exactly the same. So I wonder what you managed to find out about, talking to the international students here, about Birmingham in particular before you came to the UK. I actually grew up in the West Midlands as well. I came from Wolverhampton. So I don't know, did they tell you before you came to Birmingham that every part of the UK has a different accent, but that the West Midlands has the best accent of all? I don't know if they told you that before you came. So you need to know something about the culture. I haven't done much travelling. I've lived in the UK all my life, but I did move from England to Wales. I was born in England. I lived the first 40 years of my life in England. Then I moved to Wales and I've been here ever since. And before I moved to Wales, I knew that Wales was different in some ways from England. For example, I knew that people in Wales, don't know if you've discovered this, international friends, are very, very interested in a sport called rugby. Yeah, I knew that before I came here. But what I didn't realise until I got here, I should have been told this, is that how much it matters to people in Wales that Wales beat England when they play them at rugby. It matters very, 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 very much. Now, it would have been helpful for me to have known that before I came here. Now, so basic facts we need to know and things about the culture. And there are some similarities here with turning to a story part of the way through the Bible. Firstly, there are basic facts you need to know. Truths that if you'd read right from the beginning, by the time you got to Luke's story, Luke's biography about Jesus, you'd have known these things already. So we need to know some basic facts. And then, secondly, there are things about the culture of the particular country where this particular part of the Bible story takes place at the particular time it takes place. So Luke's Gospel, Luke's biography of Jesus, is written or describes events that were around about AD 30, so nearly 2,000 years ago. And in Israel, they took place in Israel, which at the time, what we now know of as Israel, which at the time was part of the Roman Empire. So what was it like to be in Israel at that particular time, in that particular situation in history? So I've got four points, as you see from the handout this morning. And the first one is really looking at the basic facts, the things that if you'd read the Bible from the beginning, you'd know by the time you got to Luke. And the second one is looking at something about the culture, about the sort of characters in this story and what they were like, things that everybody would have known at the time. And then in the third and the fourth, we'll go on to say, okay, what is this story telling us? How does this apply to us? Okay, and as I often say to the people who meet here every week, the first point is the longest, all right? It's apparently good if you're talking that they get shorter as you go on. Okay. Right, so firstly, truths we need to know about God and ourselves. And firstly, quite simply, we need to know there is a God. This story is about two men praying, talking to God. Verse 10, two men went up to the temple to pray, and they both addressed God. Verse 11, the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God. The tax collector does a similar thing in verse 13. The most basic fact that the Bible teaches us is that there is a God. It's how the Bible starts. The very first four words in the Bible, first book of the Bible, first chapter, first verse, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God. And that first sentence in the Bible completes Genesis 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Before there was a universe, there was God. God is eternal. God's always been. God created the entire universe, including our world, out of nothing. God has absolute power. But God is a person. He's not just a power. The universe, our world, life, human beings like us, did not come about by chance. Our universe and everything in it was designed. We were designed and made by a personal creator, by God. So that means, that's wonderful, because that means human life can have some real meaning and some purpose, because there is a God to give it meaning and purpose. And it also means that above all else, in life, we are dealing with God. Life involves all sorts of relationships, doesn't it? With our parents, with other family members, with neighbours, with fellow students, with fellow workers, with the government, and so on and so on. But the fact that there is a God means that there is one relationship that is bigger, more important than any other relationship. The relationship we have with God. So the biggest question is, what does God think of us? How should we relate to God? To answer those questions, we need to know not just about there's a God and about the power of God, we also need to know about the character of God. And the Bible teaches us that the one true God, the only God who really exists, is not just eternal and powerful, but he is perfect in his character. He is truly good. I'm going to come up on the screen some verses from one of the earliest books in the Bible, the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verses 3 and 4. And they're about God. It's a song. I will proclaim the name of the Lord. Oh, praise the greatness of our God. He is the rock. His works are perfect and all his ways are just. A faithful God who does no wrong. Upright and just is he. God always does what is right. There is a lot of debate around the world about ethics, about what is right and what is wrong. Some people deny that there are absolute rights and absolute wrongs, that there are moral absolutes. In other words, they deny that there are ways of behaving that are always right or always wrong, wherever you are in the world and at whatever point in history. Some people deny that. They say, no, no, there are no absolute rights and wrongs. But the fact that there is a God who is perfectly good, who is perfectly righteous, as the word is, he's perfectly right, he's righteous, means that there are moral absolutes. Because you see, God determines what is right and wrong. God determines what is good and what is evil. If our world has just come about by chance, then there is no right and wrong, because there's nobody to say what is right and what is wrong. There is no real right and wrong if we're just here by chance. But because there is a God, then there is right and wrong. There is good and evil. And that good and evil covers what we probably think of as moral issues. Don't commit adultery, don't steal. And it also covers what we might think of as religious issues. Trust in God. Honour God. Obey God. See, the Pharisee in this story understood that it covered both moral areas and religious areas. Verse 11, the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. Now, we'll look later at whether he was right in what he said or wrong, but recognize that he sees that God's interested in things like adultery and stealing, but he's also interested in whether you fast, he's also interested in whether you give money to him and to the poor and so on. He's interested in what we might think of as moral issues and what we might think of as religious issues. And that means, because there's a God and he determines what is right and wrong, that means that doing wrong is not just a matter of whether we break the law of the country. It's also a matter of whether we break God's laws, God's rules, God's commands. And if we disobey God's commands, we are what the Bible calls sinners. Look at verse 13. The tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. See, a sinner is someone who's broken their relationship with God. Sin is against God. It's not just against the law of the country. You can perfectly obey the laws of your country and still be a sinner because you aren't trusting in God and honouring God and obeying God as you should. So to understand what this part of the Bible, that we will get there in a bit, is teaching, we need to know that there is a God who is all-powerful, who created the universe out of nothing. And that means that the one relationship that matters more than any other is the relationship with God. We need to know that this God is perfect, he is righteous. We need to know that means there is absolute right and wrong. We need to know that that covers moral things like stealing, but it also covers what we might think of as religious things, like do we trust and honour and obey God? And we need to know that if we fail to, in any way, to meet God's requirements, fail to meet God's standards, we are sinners. To have a relationship with God, we need to be righteous like God is righteous. We need to be a situation where God examines all the evidence about us, what we do, what we say, what we think, and then God decides that we are righteous. That's what we need. And that's what this story is all about. Look at verse 9, the first verse. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Okay, so this story, this parable Jesus tells, is about whether we are righteous or not, whether we have righteousness or not. And the Bible teaches that God is perfectly just in how he decides this. Standing before God is like being in a court in a country where the laws are perfect. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And more than that, where the judge you are standing before knows exactly what you have done. There's not going to be any miscarriage of justice because he misunderstands the evidence. And where the judge is perfectly just in carrying out their responsibilities as a judge. That'd be wonderful, wouldn't it? And God is like that, to have a perfect judge. And if God decides that you are righteous, that you have met up to his perfect standards of right and wrong, you are declared, and this is the last big word, you are declared to be justified. Verse 14, the last verse I read, the last verse of the passage, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. So our greatest need as human beings is to be justified before God. Okay, so that's like learning the basic facts about our world. There is a God who's righteous. We need to be righteous, but we're sinners. How can we be justified? They're the key things we need to understand as we come to this passage. But in this story, this parable that Jesus told, he is using characters, a Pharisee and a tax collector, who belong in his day, in his country. You know, they turn to other bits of the Bible, you won't find any Pharisees or tax collectors. Not in the stories. I think you find tax collectors in every culture, don't you? But okay. The people of his day would have understood perfectly. Oh, yes, Pharisee, I know what they are. Tax collector, oh, I know what they are. But for us, it's like moving to another part of the UK and needing to understand the culture of that area. So my second heading, remember the first is the longest, don't worry, first is the longest. Second heading, do you think you need justice or mercy? Do you think you need justice or mercy? So in 30 AD, nearly 2,000 years ago, in the country of Israel, then part of the Roman Empire, who were Pharisees, who were tax collectors? Pharisees were very religious people. They were the most religious people in Israel at the time. They were people who studied the part of the Bible that had been written before Jesus came to earth. They who studied that part of the Bible and tried very, very, very hard to keep the rules they found there. In fact, they were so religious, and they were so convinced that being justified before God was all about keeping rules, that they actually thought, look, the rules in the Bible aren't detailed enough. So they made up a lot more rules and kept those, or tried to keep them as well. Look at verse 12. This is the Pharisees praying here. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. Now, the Bible does talk about giving a tenth in the Old Testament, in that part of the Bible before Jesus. But there's nowhere in the Bible where it says you must fast twice a week. They didn't find that rule in the Bible. They'd made that rule up. They said, I think you're only obliged to fast once a year. But they said, wow, if God wants us to fast once a year, he'll be more impressed if we fast once a week. I tell you what, let's be really keen. We'll do it twice a week. Then he'll be really, really impressed with us. So the Pharisees were very, very religious. And most of the people in Israel at the time of Jesus, the time Jesus was on earth, would have thought, if you were going to say, think of a good person, they'd have said, Pharisee. They thought the Pharisees were very, very good people. And I'll just let you into a secret. The Pharisees thought that too. The Pharisees thought they were very, very good people. And they thought that justice demanded that God would accept them. They thought all they needed from God was justice. If God is just, we'll be fine. We'll be justified. Are you like that? Do you think all God has to be is fair and just and I'll be fine because I'm a good person and I'm a religious person? That's the Pharisees. What about the tax collectors? I think we all instinctively know a bit about tax collectors, but we need to know a bit more to understand tax collectors at the time of this story. In Jesus' day, remember, his country, the country of Israel, was part of the Roman Empire. In other words, Israel was a conquered country. It was an occupied country. So a tax collector wasn't working for a Jewish government. He was working for the Romans, the enemy. And the Romans got a clever system. They didn't want to be too unpopular, so they got Jews to become tax collectors. And the system was this. As a Jew, the Romans said, this is how much tax we want you to collect for us, but what you need to make a living, you collect that on top of it, all right? So the tax collectors collected lots and lots and kept a lot for themselves. The Romans didn't mind about that. As long as the Romans got the amount they wanted, they didn't mind how much the tax collectors collected. So a tax collector was a thief and was a traitor, a man who had made himself rich by exploiting his fellow countrymen. First century Jews didn't make jokes about taxmen, which is probably what we do in this country. They wanted to kill them. They spat on them when they passed. They cursed the ground they walked on. So Pharisees were seen as, who's as good as we can get? A Pharisee. Pharisees were seen as very good. Who's as bad can be in our country? Oh, that's easy. Tax collectors. Do you think of yourself as good and justly deserving praise from God, or do you think of yourself as bad and needing mercy? So you understand the truth, the facts that Jesus assumes as he tells his story and his hearers are familiar with. You now understand a bit about the culture, who Pharisees were, who tax collectors were. Now the issue that Jesus is looking at is how can we be justified before God? How can we be acceptable to God? How can we be welcomed into a relationship with God rather than being condemned by God and rejected by him? Thirdly, my third heading, we need mercy, not justice. Jesus tells a story. It's a story about a Pharisee and a tax collector. They both go to the temple to pray. Listen to the story again, verses 10 to 13. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, God, I thank you that I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. The question that Jesus' hearers and we, the readers, are being invited to ask, to think about is, which of these two do you think was accepted by God? Which of these two was justified before God? Which of these two did God decide was righteous? Well, that's an easy one. I know some of our young people are doing exams at the moment. If you've got that as a question exam, that's a doddle. That, the Pharisee, of course. He's the good person. Yeah, God, he's as good can be. God will accept the Pharisee. That's the obvious answer. And the tax collector? Ha, I know all about them. God won't accept a tax collector. That's the obvious answer. they're really, really bad. Okay, this one admits he's a bad man and he asks for mercy, but that's like a murderer being in court and saying, Your Honor, to the judge, I admit I've done something really, really evil. Please forgive me. No way. The tax collector, he'll be condemned. He'll be punished. That's what we'd expect. But look at what Jesus says after telling the story. Verse 14. After telling us about the tax collector's prayer, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. It's the tax collector, not the Pharisee, who goes home justified. How can that be? We need to look at the introduction to the story to realize why. Verse 9. To some who were confident of their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. The story is for the sake of people who are confident of their own righteousness and look down on others. Jesus, as we'd say in English, shines the spotlight onto the attitude of our hearts. Are we proud? Do we think we are very, very good? And better, in fact, than other people? Listen again to the Pharisee's prayer. God, I thank you that I am not like other people. And then he lists the things he doesn't do, and then he lists the good things he does do. This man, the Pharisee, thinks he is a really, really good person. He knows he's good at keeping rules. He knows he's very religious, and he thinks he's done really, really well. In fact, he thinks he's done better than anyone else. In fact, he thinks he's done so well that God should accept him. If we had to describe him in one word, I think we would have to use the word proud. You might say, well, what's the problem with that? If I do really, really well at something, some of you might be studying for PhDs, and if you get your PhD, well, I've every right to be proud. I've worked hard. But hold on. What this passage is all about is about our relationship with God, about being righteous enough for God. About meeting up to God's standards. We might be better than other people, but God is perfectly righteous. And to be accepted by him, we need to be perfectly righteous too. And the simple fact is that none of us are perfect. Once Jesus was asked, it's in Mark's biography of Jesus, which of God's commandments was the most important? And he answered like this. This is in Mark's Gospel, chapter 12, verses 29 to 31. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. Has anybody here kept that commandment, those commandments? Have you loved God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? And have you loved your neighbor? And the Bible says your neighbor is anyone you come across. Have you loved them as much as you love yourself? Well, I failed, and I'm sure everybody in this room has failed. We're not good enough. If it comes to justice, then all of us deserve to be condemned by God. We've no reason to be proud before God. See, what we need is not justice. What we need is mercy. And that means it's time to listen again to the tax collector's prayer, verse 13. The tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. He knew he was a sinner. He knew he'd fallen way, way short of God's standards. He knew he needed mercy. He cried out to God for mercy. And Jesus says that those who humbly seek mercy from God will be lifted up, will be justified, rather than those who come proud before God will actually be humbled, brought down. Verse 14, for all, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted. God simply forgave the tax collector. He gave him mercy. He gave him what he didn't deserve. He justified him. But how can God do this? How can God be just and yet forgive a terrible sinner such as that tax collector at the time of Jesus? Fourthly and finally, and most briefly, God can justly be merciful because of Jesus. God can justly be merciful because of Jesus. See, the Bible's answer to how can God justly forgive people like you and me is a wonderful answer. It is that the Son of God became a man, came into our world as a man. That's what Christians celebrate at Christmas. The Lord Jesus Christ, born as one of us, still God, but became a man. He lived the perfect life that all of us have failed to live. He truly was righteous. He then died on the cross the death that we deserve to die. That's what Christians celebrate on what we call Good Friday. He took the punishment our sin deserved. And that way, God can both justly punish our sin, because Jesus has willingly, voluntarily been punished in our place, and can therefore justly show mercy to us who humbly come to Jesus for forgiveness. This is how a verse in the Bible, in one of Peter's letters, a letter from one of the early Christian leaders, one of Jesus' 12 disciples, this is how he put it. 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 18. Peter's first letter, chapter 3, verse 18. For Christ also suffered once for sins. The righteous, that's Jesus Christ. For the unrighteous, that's you and me, to bring you to God, so that you and I can have a relationship with God. See, at the very heart of the Bible's message, the very heart of Christianity, is grace. Grace is a wonderful word. It means being good to those who don't deserve it. Mercy, I suppose, is not punishing those who do deserve it, but grace goes further. It's actually being positively good to those who don't deserve it. God is wonderfully good to us, and we don't deserve it. We deserve to be rejected by God. We deserve to be punished by God. We're sinners, and God is perfectly righteous, and God is just as a judge. But God has made a way for us to be forgiven, for us to be justified, for us to be accepted by Him, a way that cost Him a great deal, because His Son, the Son of God, had to become a man and die in our place. And we need to respond by saying, yes, I believe the good news. I've heard the good news that God is gracious, God is merciful, that there is a way that I can be forgiven. And then, like the tax collector, cry out to God, God, I'm a sinner, I don't deserve your goodness, but I'm pleading for mercy. Please forgive me. And the wonderful news is that if we do, we will be justified. Verse 14, I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted.